Welcome everybody to Parshas Behar. Just to review, in these weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we are approaching the Parsha with a three-prong objective. Number one is to deal with the Parsha, naturally. Number two is to stick with our theme for the year, which involves the study and reference to the Mesilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just, by Rabbi Luzzatto. Number three is to tackle a different quality each week as well. So like, we have 6 weeks. Week number one, we focused on Zahirus, vigilance. Week number two, we focused on our second quality, that of alacrity, Zerizus. So this week, we should focus on our third quality, cleanliness, Nikius. So let's give a brief overview of Nikius. We have discussed it throughout the year on different occasions, but let's talk a little bit about what is this cleanliness all about. So if you'd like to follow page 53, the virtue of cleanliness. The virtue of cleanliness is associated with a person who has completely cleansed himself of all bad traits and all sin. This means not only those sins that are acknowledged as such and are clearly recognizable, but also those that the heart has been seduced into rationalizing as permissible. Clean means, in other words, there's observant, there's basically observant, and then there's clean. Basically observant means I do the big things, but there's still lots of gray areas that I'm not so adherent in. Cleanliness means fully. In actuality, when we look into the matter, we will discover that the only reason one considers these things permissible is because his heart is still slightly afflicted by lustful desire. He is not entirely cleansed of it, and therefore it is able to entice him toward leniency. So listen to the interplay between desire and knowledge for a moment. I might desire something, but if I know that I can't have it, then it's not a question. I might desire to have the pork, but if I know without a shadow of a doubt that pork is forbidden, I'm just going to put it out of my mind. But let's say I desire something, and it's not so clear to me, my knowledge is not that exact, and I don't know for sure that it's not kosher, and I could somehow come up with a rationalization that, well, it could be kosher, it's probably kosher, or it's mostly kosher, or whatever the rationalization type of language might be, then my desire will overcome my weak kind of knowledge, and I will do the sin. So the way to combat, the way to gain cleanliness, is really like a two-prong approach. One has to work on subduing the desire on one end, and on increasing the knowledge on the other end, so that I don't have all these gray areas in my knowledge. But let me read a little bit more about that. That's kind of in my own words. But Rabbi Luzzatto says, you can now see the difference between one who possesses the virtue of vigilance, which is kind of a basic observant person, and one who possesses the virtue of cleanliness, even though they are similar to each other in their makeup. The vigilant person is one who is careful about his actions, makes sure not to sin in those areas that are already known to him, and that are universally acknowledged as sin. However, such a person is not sufficiently master over himself to prevent himself from being emotionally drawn towards his innate desire, which then misleads him by permitting him those things whose evil is not widely known. This means that although he tries to conquer his evil inclination, after all, he is vigilant and subdue his desires, this will not change his very nature. He will still be incapable of removing corporal lust from his heart. All he can do is sublimate it, pursue wisdom rather than lust. But the darkness of corporeality is nevertheless effective in swaying him and enticing him. So, a person who is still filled with the basic desires and his knowledge is kind of weak, what is his treatment? What is his solution? So in chapter 12, page 90, he gives us some instruction concerning this matter. Therefore, it is essential that a person have a crystal clear knowledge of the halachos, which are the laws, in order to understand the overall applicability of all the branches of the mitzvos. Furthermore, because forgetfulness is prevalent with regard to these minute details, one must devote continual study to those works that expound on these details in order to refresh one's memory. Then, one will undoubtedly be spurred on to fulfill them. Rabbi Luzzatto goes on to add, it's not only true in matters of halacha, of Jewish law, but it's also applicable to character development and to our character traits. It demands a study of the ethical writings of the earlier or later authorities. Things like kindness, haughtiness, good traits, bad traits, stingy, mean, self-centered, angry, all these things. A person can think himself to be basically in control in these areas, but there's a lot of details that can be overlooked. Even after one has decided to join the ranks of those who are meticulous in cleanliness, he may quite often find himself in error regarding the details, the reason being that he has not yet learned them. One is not born wise, and he can't be expected to know everything. But by studying these works, he will be made aware of what he did not know, and he will reflect on what he had not comprehended originally, etc. So cleanliness, in a large way, is a product of learning, and learning specifics, learning thoroughly, learning details.
Why is it called cleanliness?
Why is it called cleanliness?
It's not hygiene.
No, it's not physical hygiene, but it's spiritual hygiene. Your child is playing out in the mud, and he comes home and he wants to eat, and you say, well, your hands are filthy. So he'll rub them on his pants and say, okay, is that better? You'll say, well, maybe you got some of the big mud off, but your hands are far from clean. You got to go to the kitchen or to the bathroom sink. You got to wash with soap and water. That's the same thing with mitzvos. A person can say, sure, I do mitzvos. I'm observant. I don't sin. I didn't rob a bank today. I didn't rape anyone. I did not serve idols. Hey, I'm a good guy. Good. So there's no mud on your soul. But is it clean? You got to study. You got to get the details to prepare spiritually and mentally for the upcoming Shavuos holiday. Why do we have to prepare for a holiday so far in advance? Well, because that is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to count the days between Pesach and Shavuos. Count up. Today is the 26th day of the count. And counting is for purposes of preparing. Is it not? In fact, as we've mentioned in previous classes, the whole purpose of our exodus from Egypt was in order to receive the Torah. So it is traditional that during these weeks we give special focus to the readiness that we are trying to engender within ourselves for receiving the Torah. So that is our three-pronged objective, and we try to do it simultaneously with his help. So let's start off our discussion with our second prong, the Mesilas Yesharim. Now, with this introduction, I think we will immediately be sparked when we read the first Rashi of the Parsha Behar. I brought the Art Scroll Rashi edition so I can get a very professionally written translation of the Rashi. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor. Let's do it with the Torah trump. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe behar Sinai lemor. Hashem spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai, saying, Daber el bnei Yisrael v'amarta aleihem ki savo el haaretz asher ani nosein lochem v'shav so haaretz shabbos l'shem. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall observe a Sabbath rest for Hashem. Sabbath for the land. Which Sabbath is this? Is this the Sabbath, the regular Shabbos, that on day 7, on Saturday, we don't work our land? No, this is a different kind of Sabbath. For 6 years you may sow your field, and for 6 years you may prune your vineyard, and you may gather in its crop. But on the seventh year, a complete rest there shall be for the land, a Shabbos for Hashem. Your field you shall not sow, and your vineyard you shall not prune. For how long? For one whole year. The aftergrowth of your harvest you shall not reap, and the grapes of your keeping away you shall not pick. It shall be a year of rest for the land. The resting of the land shall be yours to eat, for you, for your slave, and for your maidservant, and for your hired worker, and for one who resides with you, and for your animal, and for the beast that is in your land, shall all its crop be to eat. You're allowed to eat whatever grows naturally, but you're not allowed to plant. You're not allowed to work the land. You may eat from the land, but you may not work it. And you must, the halacha tells us, you must allow anyone to eat from your land as well. Basically, on the sabbatical year, the whole land of Israel belongs to Hashem. You are not its owner. You may not take possession of it. If there's a tree, you may not gather in all of its fruits and store them in your house and hoard them. You must allow anyone to come and eat. It's Shabbos. We call this the mitzvah of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, or the year of release. That is the first mitzvah in Bahar. And this year, in the land of Israel, they are observing this Shemitah, this land of rest, this year. Now, the very first verse has something peculiar. Hashem spoke to Moshe. We're familiar with the refrain, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, but it says, Hashem spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai saying. So far, we've only dealt with the verses. Rashi asks the question, why did it add the words on Mount Sinai? Or in Rashi's words, what is the matter of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, doing next to Mount Sinai? Meaning, why does the Torah say on Mount Sinai, specifically in the context of the laws of Shemitah, as opposed to other laws? Were not all of the commandments stated at Sinai? That's Rashi's question. The Torah singles out the sabbatical year to say Hashem said to Moshe this on Mount Sinai. You know how there's an expression in the secular world when two people are having a conversation and one person calls out something which seems to be totally irrelevant to the conversation. What is the expression that you say? Finish this phrase. What does that have to do with the price of tea in China? What does that have to do with the price of tea in China? Well, guess what they say in the Torah world? Ma inyan Shemitah etzel Har Sinai. What does the laws of Shemitah have to do with Mount Sinai? That's how you say it. You cite these words. In other words, it's a non sequitur. Hashem spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai saying the laws of Shemitah. Why specifically the laws of Shemitah for Mount Sinai? The entire Torah was given on Mount Sinai. Yes.
Ten commandments are man to man and man to God.
Mm-hmm.
This is man to land.
Man to land.
And Moshe, this is a different lesson to learn for Klal Yisrael.
It's God to man about land.
And, well,
but you're saying this is like a fundamental issue.
This is a separate entity.
And a separate entity.
And therefore has to be expressed that way.
Okay. So this is...
its significance is so great.
Yes.
Because of the land of Israel, that it was put, you know, with Moses at Sinai.
Okay. We're going to come to that. Let's go through the steps. Rashi first gives an immediate answer to this, and then it is developed in the direction in which you're going. Rashi gives the answer. He's quoting from the Midrash. It is written here to teach that Ma Shmita Nemru Klaloseha Ufratoseha V'diktu Keha Misinai, just as with Shmita, the sabbatical year, its general rules and its details and its fine points were stated at Sinai. Afkulan, so too with all of the commandments, Nemru Klalosehen V'diktu Kehen Misinai, their general rules and their fine points were stated at Sinai. Rashi's answer, and it needs to be explained, is Shemitah is placed here because Shemitah is a mitzvah that we know it was taught with its general laws and its details and fine points. And since Shemitah was taught that way, the Torah is informing us that that is a model for all mitzvahs. All mitzvahs were taught that way. All mitzvahs were taught with general rules, details, and fine points. Do you see what I meant when I said, after our introduction from Rabbi Luzzatto, we would perk up when we hear the words of Rashi? Rashi is mentioning general rules, details, and fine points as they relate to the mitzvahs. Now, we still have to delve into this further. What is the significance of that? And there's also a question that people say, how did Rashi know? Or how did the sages of the Midrash know that the laws of Shemitah were given with general rules and details and fine points? Where does it say that? Where is the fine print? And when you look at the Chumash, when you read the Torah, there aren't really any fine small print. There's just the text itself. Where does it say that there's fine points? I mean, a lot of people could ask the question, where does it say anywhere in the Chumash? I get the question all the time. Where does it say that you have to have your tzitzis showing? Where does it say that you have to wear a hat? Where does it say that you're not allowed to listen to a woman singing? Where does it say that the men and the women aren't allowed to sit together at the shul? Where does it say this? Where does it say that?
Is it in the oral law?
Well, that's basically what Rashi is saying. That when God taught the Torah to Moshe, he didn't just give him the Chumash. He didn't just say, keep Shabbos like it reads in the Ten Commandments. You think that when Moshe went to Mount Sinai, Hashem just gave him a list of commandments? No, he gave him Klal Oseihen, general rules, Ufratoseha, and details, and Diktukeha, and fine points. Two questions remain unanswered. Let me restate them. I don't even know if I did state them. Question number one is, why pick on Shemitah as the model for general rules, details, and fine points? And second question is, why is it so significant that there are rules and details and fine points? Why is this lesson so important? The Torah emphasizes it. So let's answer the first question first, and the second question second. The first question, why Shemitah, is, as Dan started to speak, Shemitah is a mitzvah that's in a class of its own. It is such a profound, such a radical commandment. So much so that one of the commentators points out, it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that God must have written the Torah. If you look at your footnotes in the stone.
He would give him a bigger crop after the year of Shemitah and before.
And before it, yeah. Yeah. And he says, what man would ever come up with such a mitzvah? Don't work the land for a whole year. And I'm reading from the footnotes. This commandment proves that only God is the author of the Torah, because this chapter guarantees that the year before Shemitah will produce a crop large enough to last for 3 years until the next available crop is harvested. If a human being were inventing such a commandment, he would have to be foolhardy indeed to make such a prediction. Only God could make such a statement. We didn't read that in the but if you look at the next paragraph, a few paragraphs later, the question is you're going to say, well, how are we supposed to eat on the sabbatical year? And God says, don't worry, you will have enough. Only God can make such a claim. So it's a radical mitzvah. It's more than that. Rav Yerucham Levavitz, who I often refer back to, he says that what the Torah is teaching us here is really the whole idea of mitzvos. What is the whole idea of mitzvos anyway? Why are we commanded to do so many things? He cites from an early authority, the Ravad, Rabbi Avraham ben David, contemporary or slightly after the Rambam, who writes the following. He says, the reason why we are commanded to do our mitzvos, leman yeda ha'adam, ki yesh lo bore hamoshel alaf, in order for a person to know that he has a creator who rules him. Within the course of time, within the course of normal life, it is very, very likely that a person will come to think that he is the boss. After all, God gave us the numerous beneficent gifts of entering a land, giving us soil, giving us ready-made homes, which were built and furnished by our predecessors, blessing us with the greatest agriculture in the world. And as we begin to enjoy and to earn and to reap, it is very, very likely, in fact, it is almost natural and inevitable, that a man will consider himself to be the owner, the founder, the boss, with no rulership above him. Hashem wants to train man within the realm of free choice, without shoving it down our throats, within the realm of free choice, as we are well aware of, that God really does rule us, that He, in fact, gave us all of our presence, and that He continues to have dominion over us. And that is why He gave mitzvos in the area of all parts of life. For example, and Rabbi Yerucham quotes this list from the Ravan. There are laws pertaining to marriage. When a person finds a wife, it is a gift from God, and God regulates that relationship. When God gives man land, He gives him numerous commandments not to mix certain seeds together, not to completely harvest all of his field, leaving some for the poor. If some of the sheaves are dropped, he may not go back and take them. He must leave them for the poor. If he forgets to bring in some of the sheaves, he's got to leave them for the poor. When he comes to process them, he must separate a percent and give that to the Kohen and to the poor. When he bakes bread, he must separate some of the dough and give that to the Kohen. Before eating, he must make blessings. After eating, he must make blessings. And the same thing is with a vineyard. And the same thing is with his clothing. He's regulated. He may not mix wool and linen. He must attach fringes to the corners of a four-cornered garment. When it comes to his animals, he is regulated not to crossbreed, to dedicate the firstborn to the temple. This morning, our good friend Terry Tenenbaum, who has just reopened the bakery under the name Simone, this morning was his first day. I believe what he told me was that he was selling challahs, $3 cash. It's from 7:30 until he sells it out, and all the proceeds from the first day are going to Yad Liad, which is a fund to provide food for families, the first whole day. But around 7 o'clock, he walks in to the Beis Midrash. I have a little group that we study in the morning before the 7:30 minyan, and he comes in with a little bag, and he says, "This is my firstborn challah." And he says, "I'm bringing this as an offering." And he handed it to me.
That's beautiful.
There are mitzvot that circumscribe our own bodies, such as circumcision for a male. Our time is regulated. We have to observe Shabbos. We have to observe Yom Tov. All of this is to train us, not just that God exists, not that just that God exists in an existential or a theological way, that God is our master. He is Adon Olam. He is the master of the world over me. And that is the foundation of this parsha. God tells Moshe at Har Sinai, when you come into the land, you have all of these responsibilities. Sabbatical year. Bang. One whole year, you're not allowed to work. That's why it's so big. The land's rest at the seventh year teaches that the primary force in the universe is God, not the law of nature. By leaving his fields untended and unguarded for a year, the Jew demonstrates that this world is but a corridor leading to the ultimate world, that true life comes when man stops striving for material gain in favor of dedication to spiritual growth. Okay, there's so many lessons that can be learned from Shemitah, but the overarching message of the Torah is, there is a God, and he is my master. And that explains why Shemitah is held up as the quintessential mitzvah, as if God is saying, at Har Sinai I gave you the Torah. You know what my banner mitzvah is? Shemitah. Because Shemitah drives home the point that there is a God who regulates our lives. Now, coming back to our second question, why such a big deal over the general rules and the details and the fine points. And here is where I think Rabbi Luzzatto will help us understand. If a mitzvah to me is just something general, something that you kind of basically do it, but it's not really specific, and when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of how I do this or how I do that, I can basically navigate myself. Or as Rabbi Luzzatto says, rationalize. It's a lot of gray area. Sure, I basically do the mitzvah. But are there any details? Not really. I'm not familiar with them. If I'm going to be able to rationalize my way through the mitzvah, then what good is the mitzvah going to be? How is it going to train me and teach me that God is my master if it's not specific? How effective is it going to be to teach me that I have a master if I can basically make up the rules as I go along? If it's not specific enough, if it's just a general theological principle that I can say, oh sure, I do that, but what do I do in the day-to-day? What do I do in my farm? What do I do in my office? Basically, however I figure, then the mitzvah is not effective. As Rabbi Luzzatto said, I won't be clean. And if I'm not clean, the effect is, applying what Rabbi Yerucham says, I'm basically, I don't have a master. Because I call the shots. Therefore, says Rashi, and drives the point home, at Mount Sinai, it was not a philosophical or a theological presentation. It was a presentation of rules and regulations from the most general to the most specific to the fine points. That's what the Torah was. It wasn't just a wow sound and light show where we became aware that there's this existential force in the world called God, and for us to sit and marvel and say, great, man, amazing. It was a harness. It was rules and regulations that forced us to train in accepting that God is our master. Without that, then the mitzvah has no effect. I believe that that's what the import that Rashi is placing on the diktukeha and klaloseha, on the general and the details and the fine points. And as Rabbi Luzzatto brings it out, without that, we rationalize. And if we rationalize, we don't learn the lesson.
The logic of this breaks down in the context of free choice, surely, because if you extrapolate this to the nth degree, and each and every aspect of our life is regulated to the point where we don't even need to make choices because we're so regulated and so trained, quote-unquote, free choice flies out the window at that point.
It is our free choice whether to submit ourselves to the regulations.
Initially, but ultimately no. Ultimately we become robotic.
Ultimately we become intertwined with Hashem. And that is the greatest freedom, as we discussed in our class on Pesach. The greatest freedom is the ability to soar, to become what we have the potential to become. It is not the freedom of a bird. It's not the freedom of an animal, and it's not even the freedom of a human being. It is the unique freedom of a Jew. For that, we have to listen to the class on freedom. But if we don't adopt the regulations, then we're still autonomous. And if we're autonomous, then we haven't changed, and we haven't accepted God as our master. And we're not free to become the Jew. How does that relate to preparing for Shavuos, preparing to receive the Torah? I think the message is quite clear now, that receiving the Torah is receiving the Torah as a body of rules, details, and fine points. That is what the Torah is. As Rashi says, just like Shemitah was given with rules and details and fine points, so were all the mitzvos. By definition, accepting the Torah is accepting the totality of the Torah. Again, it's not just an existential, we're joining the club, we're standing around Mount Sinai, we're united, we're unified. Yay. It is a personal acceptance that this is what the Torah is. Now, as with everything, do we ever say that a person is expected to go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds? Is a person expected to fulfill every detail? We never expect more of a person than what he or she can do. Spiritual growth is, of course, very personal and very individualized. But what does it mean to accept the Torah? What is that concept? That concept is to accept a system of God's mastery over us as individuals and as a community. But it is this dimension of kloloseha, prateha, v'tiktukeha, of general, of details, of fine points. Without that, it's kind of like a game. I can be part of a club without really personal responsibility. And when we don't have that personal responsibility and that yoke of the mitzvos and of the detailed halachos, the only one that's losing out is ourselves, because we are failing to become trained in the reality of Hashem, the Master. This is the dimension of Kabbalah HaTorah, the acceptance of the Torah, the dimension, and there are many dimensions, and we have discussed already, this is our third week of preparing for Kabbalah HaTorah, but this is the dimension of Kabbalah HaTorah, of receiving the Torah, which I think is borne out by the trait of cleanliness. I think that it has been adequately supported by the prominence of Rashi's statement about the details, and I think that the ultimate significance has been driven home by Rav Yerucham, that if the purpose, quoting the Ravad, that if the purpose of the mitzvos is to train us to accept God's mastery over us, then it will necessitate that we submit ourselves first up here. You know, everything has to come first with a choice, but we have to submit ourselves that this is what the Torah is. What the Torah is a system of laws which are given to us, whose purpose is to enable us to attach ourselves to God in a true, real, tangible, and personal way. This is the dimension of Kabbalah HaTorah that we'd like to propose for this week.
Okay.
Further questions?
Rabbi, you can't, yes. Get, you can't be an outreach rabbi and say, yoke. If I didn't have knowledge,
yeah.
And I heard that I have to bear the yoke of doing all these mitzvahs in order to relate to Hashem.
Good job.
I don't know if I'd be motivated to learn the knowledge. And there's a very fine line with people who don't have knowledge of Judaism, that you can be turned off so easily. Come on, it's so strong. When I hear the word yoke,
yeah, you run. You run the other way. We all do. We all do. It's natural.
We did a
Har Sinai. Very good. The Jewish people fainted. They lost their souls. Their souls left them. So how could we do this? God revived them. I'm not giving an outreach class. I'm giving a class to the inner circle. But I am. I mean, this group is extremely, extremely knowledgeable and initiated. But it needs to be stated, and Torah states it.
The practice of Shemitah, in vernacular terms, is letting the land lie fallow. That's an English usage. And that practice has been used in American agriculture for many years.
You mean like what they call crop rotation?
Yes.
Yeah.
And letting the land lie fallow for not using it for a while.
Right.
Because I don't know how it was learned by farmers, certainly not from the Torah.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Maybe it was. But, you know, the difference between crop rotation and Shemitah is that in crop rotation, you take a percentage of your land and let it lie fallow. Nobody ever suggests that none of the land is worked.
Oh.
That's the novel of Shemitah.
No, those are actually two things.
Really?
Crop rotation, you can use the same land
but different
in
crops.
Succeeding years
right.
For different crops.
Okay. Okay.
Corn, then wheat, then oats.
Right, because then it's different nutrients.
Letting the land lie fallow means you don't grow any crops. And until the modern industrial age, when fertilizers were broadly used and so on, prior to that, farmers would practice
But even when they did, even when they did they ever, would one farmer let his entire...
No,
we would pick a certain corner, right? So that's the novelty.
Right, so
the novelty of Shemitah is that we are committing ourselves not to work at all and to trust God that He will provide for us during those years. That's definitely.
In another class that I was in, we were talking about Shemitah. Someone mentioned to me she has a home in Israel that they go to, you know, frequently, although they generally live here. And she said the landscaper, the gardener who takes care of the lawns, this year he's learning in Kollel because I had never thought of it. But even the grass and the lawns,
they
can mow it, but it has to grow pretty high.
Oh, really?
So when they're buying vegetables, they're buying from non-Jews, is that correct? In Israel?
This is a debate on the subject.
Well, in prior years, they were buying from Arab sources, and there was an epidemic of hepatitis A because of...
Everyone agrees that you can buy the vegetables from the Arabs. What the debate about is, can you sell the land to the Arabs so that you can then use
your own
farm, because we're working on their land. That's where the debate comes in.
Mm-hmm.
One more thought.
Yes, good job.
This whole notion of regulating behavior to this extent is kind of a sad indictment of human beings, that in order for us to understand that God is our ruler, that each and every minute aspect of our behavior must be under His control and regulated.
It's actually, when you look into it, it is regulated, but it does not take away our ability to make decisions.
The reason we do this is so that we're reminded that who is the boss.
Thank you.
That we have to be reminded, but
you know,
I mean, it's sad as human beings that we have to be reminded like that.
You can call it sad, but the reason why it is that way is because God created us with, as you, Rabbi Phillips, told us last week or a couple weeks ago, that God created us with this evil urge. Probably the strongest manifestation of this urge is to think of ourselves as autonomous. And why did God make us that way? You could say it's sad, but actually people are proud of it. But the reason why God did it was to create the challenge of finding out that there's really a God. Whether it's sad or not, that's just like crying over spilled milk. We are what we are, and the facts are that in order to truly become connected with God, we have to do this.
But that's a different... I would buy into the idea that that if you want to be close to God, you have to kind of earn it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to earn it is to honor Him by honoring His mitzvot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more you do and the better you do it, the closer you can be to God, and therefore have that sense of bliss, let's say. That I like.
Okay.
But you couched it as this being kind of a reminder, in a way.
More than a reminder, it's training. It needs to be implemented in order for that. See, we would like to believe that we can have our cake and eat it too. That we can be close to God and we can still be autonomous. That won't happen.
Okay.
That won't happen.
Very good. Thank you, Rick.
Okay.
I have a question. If you have fruit on a tree, mm-hmm. and it's the first fruit that ever appears on that tree, Richard said there was a law you couldn't touch that fruit. Is that correct?
In fact, it's correct. In fact, any fruits that grow for the first three years,
that's what
of that tree will be forbidden.
You're not allowed to touch it.
No, you're allowed to touch it. You're allowed to touch it. Are you allowed to sell it? That I'm not sure.
What?
I think you're not allowed to sell it either. I think you just have to let it be.
It.
Yeah.
Can you explain to me why?
It's just another one of those mitzvos. It's really...
Based on what?
Based on this regulation of our ownership of land. Hashem gave us the land, and He gave it to us with regulations. That's just one of them. It's no different than saying that the first crops must be brought as an offering to the temple. Your eldest son must be redeemed with the priest. It's just part of a whole litany of regulations which are given to us regarding our possessions.
Could it be because
of the knowledge
of science that the land lies fallow? so that it can regain all the nutrients that it needs to actually grow the crop.
See, that approach is an approach that people take to deny that it has anything to do with God.
No, to me it means that God is so brilliant that he knows that this is what has to happen and he's protecting the land.
Yeah, but think about it, but let's carry that through. God is protecting the land so that it can provide better fruit, so that it can serve us better, which is feeding into the same approach as it's for me, it's for my enjoyment, for my autonomy. Mitzvos are not to serve us.
No, it's not to for me.
It's not to enhance my life. The mitzvah is to teach us to discover Hashem, to become servants.
You see, I don't think that it's fallow for me.
Yeah.
But I think it's fallow so that all of Israel can use it.
But you see, if God wanted to, he could have made the fruits in such a way that they wouldn't need the 3 years to reach the highest quality. God could have created the world without the need for that conditioning.
So
everything that he did for a reason, to impact upon us and train us. Even the physical, scientific aspects. There's always a higher purpose. You know, just like some people say, well, the reason why certain foods are not kosher is because they're unhealthy. That can't be the reason for the mitzvah, because God could have created animals that were healthy. Who made them unhealthy in the first place? So the reason for the mitzvahs is not for some ecological or some practical purpose. It is to train us to accept God.
It takes us to the higher place.
Yeah.
Soybean is the only crop that will not diminish nutrients in the soil, and it could grow. Just repeat, that's the only crop. Soy happens to also be the largest commodity that replaces or will replace animal consumption. So what I'm hearing you say, and this is what I'm gathering from this, it has nothing to do about the physical. It has to do with the spiritual,
it's
and
only,
having total faith and trust that we're going to be provided for, tie our hands behind our backs, and we're still okay.
Right, and that's one aspect, is trust in God. But there's also the aspect of accepting God's sovereignty over us. God is both our supporter and also our trainer. And ultimately, every mitzvah has that purpose, to train us that God is our supporter. He is all good. He is totally giving. And what he's really trying to give us, the ultimate, is to teach us to recognize him and to become attached to him. And that is the greatest thing that he could do for us. So it's training, like an athlete. I love to think about the analogy of the athlete. An athlete puts himself through tremendous discipline and tremendous physical pain and torture. But he's striving for a higher goal.
Right, but if you go into any profession, if you want to excel, there is sacrifice, there is hardship. It might not be physical, but it might be time-consuming from
social activities,
your family, or what you would rather do, but it's the discipline.
Right. There's a higher goal,
and
that's the same with the mitzvahs, but on a much higher plane than the sports.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.